As chapter 11 in 2 Samuel was the watershed for David, so in a sense, chapter 11 of 1 Kings is a watershed for his son Solomon. There is a difference, however, and that lies in the fact that David's life was predominantly lived pleasing to God. In other words, the failure of David in chapter 11 of 2 Samuel was a one-time thing. Now, the consequences lasted for quite a while, but it was one big event in the life of David. Now, that's in contrast with Solomon's life, where he began well, and I would presume that up through the building of the temple, probably, he was walking quite closely with God. As one of you drew to my attention, that statement about the fact that he worshiped God and then also that he worshiped in the high places was probably a summary statement of his whole life, not necessarily that he did the both together at all times. But apparently after the filling of the temple, the completion of the temple, Solomon began to fail God. And I think it was really just the constant pressure of these wives and the whole of the competitive spirit in the Middle East with other sovereigns and so on, that Solomon simply lost control of the situation. He just lost control of it. There were too many dynamic factors working against him. Not too many for victory, but too many for victory in his circumstance. He'd made too many compromises. And so what we have in chapter 11 is not one event in the life of Solomon where he failed, but rather a perspective looking back over what I would conclude to be approximately the last half of his reign in which he progressively failed God. So this was a way of life. And his price for peace with the surrounding nations was actually the influx of idolatry through the wives of these other sovereigns with whom he made the compromises and made the deals. This is summarized very dramatically and, of course, very tragically in chapter 11. Everything is going along so well until we get to that first word, but, in chapter 11. But King Solomon loved many strange women. Now, as you know, in King James Version, the word strange doesn't mean that they're oddballs, but rather that they were foreigners. In other words, non-Israeli women, non-Jewish women. We get the same word in the word stranger. In other words, the stranger in the land, the foreigner, the expatriate in the land. And he named some of these. And the point is made in verse 2 that these were of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go into them, neither shall you come. They come in unto you. For surely they will turn away your hearts after God. Solomon clave unto these in love. Now, you'll remember that statement from Joshua's time. You remember it from the days of the judges. You remember it of the warnings that were given that when they came into the land, they were not to intermarry. And that was the problem for the 300 years of the days of the judges. And you and I may have thought that that had been forgotten. We may have thought that times had changed. And I think there's a good lesson for us today in this, because we may think that there are some old standards about marriage and fidelity and integrity in business and so on that somehow don't need to apply anymore because we live in another age, a more enlightened age, another era. And look at the temple, and look at Solomon, and look at the Queen of Sheba coming up. Look at the reputation we have among the nations. Look at the wealth. It must be all right. And you can see the parallel. That the Spirit of God goes right back and says the truth is still there. It's still wrong, no matter what happens. And although I don't want to get into the whole discussion of polygamy in the Old Testament here and how much it was frowned upon or smiled upon by God, I think it's very clear that God permitted many things that were not His will. And He worked in spite of them, not because of them. Having this number of concubines and wives was not a norm. And incidentally, he didn't live with these people as we think of living with a wife and so on. These, in most cases, were this was a social and an economic and a political arrangement. It certainly doesn't do much for the dignity of women to collect 1,000 women, sort of, almost like scalps, to show how great you are. They had gone a long way from one man and one woman. So there's nothing here that we can take as a norm to say, well, it's all right because look at Solomon's success. Remember that success can never be attributed to doing things right in the sense that every time we see success, it must mean that the methodology is right. God allowed a lot of things to be successful because it was his purpose. He wanted a temple built. He wanted that evidence of who he was. He wanted the one place of worship. He wanted Jerusalem. He wanted his country to be strong. He had made promises to David about his son, and he was carrying these out. But you see, God doesn't work in 5-minute intervals or 60-minute intervals or even a generation. God has all of history stretched out. And one of the ways in which I try to solve the riddle of, well, is this right, and what's God doing in this, and how could this be, and how could a righteous God do this? One of the ways I try to solve it for myself is to just move out, just to elongate the time span and see that God is dealing over generations and sometimes 1,000 years to bring something about. And if at any point along the line it doesn't seem to be working out like I think it should be, wait a while, it's going to work out. It depends on where you cut the timeline as to whether or not it's working according to God's plan. It's all according to God's plan. But at any particular slice in there, the plan isn't finished. And one day, when we stand before him, and all the ends are tied up, there won't be one frayed string left anywhere. There won't be one frayed thread. It'll all fit perfectly into place, and nothing will have been out of God's will. And then we won't be tempted to look back and say, well, Solomon had 1,000 wives. You know, why can't I have at least 2 or 3? Verse 3, his wives turned away his heart. That's the key to it, of course. In verse 4, it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. That is, as he got older, he got weaker, there was more and more pressure. His heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. For Solomon went after all of these other gods and so on, goddesses and so on. He became actually a idolater himself. And Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and went not fully after the Lord, as did David his father. Now you're going to see two refrains from now on throughout the history of the United and then the divided kingdom. And one is going to be according to his father David. And David is going to be the standard of walking with God. And later on, after Jeroboam, we're going to have the phrase that the bad ones walked after the ways of Jeroboam. So the two extremes are after the way of David and after the way of Jeroboam. We'll see that repeated several times. And incidentally, there's encouragement in this. David was not perfect. David did fall. But there was something about David's heart that was right with God, that even when he fell, he knew what to do. And he came back. And he confessed his sin. And he got right with God. And God could still hold him up as an example. And I encourage us here, because there's probably not one of us that hasn't had some serious sin or some sin we perceived as being very serious. And we had our fellowship cut off and we think, well, never after that can I ever be a model. It's encouraging to me that David was a model even after that. Because in the total view, as it all worked out, he was still a man after God's own heart. So that when he strayed, he still came back to that heart. In verse 9, the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart was turned from the Lord God of Israel, which had appeared unto him twice, that's in chapters 3 and 9, and had commanded him concerning this thing, this very thing. And in chapter 9, he warned him, don't let this happen. And he did. But he wasn't going to take away the kingdom. In verse 11, at the end of the verse, I will surely rend the kingdom from thee and will give it to thy servant. Notwithstanding, in thy days I will not do it for David thy father's sake. But I will rend it out of the hand of thy son. Do you remember in 2 Samuel 7 When God was making that promise to David, and David in effect says, yes, but what if my son sins? He says, all right, he says, I won't take it out of his hands. And so God's justice is always perfect, but his promises are always kept. And there's a fine line here. It's just a tremendous thing to see this, the intricacies of this work out. And in verse 13, howbeit I will not rend away all thy kingdom, but will give one tribe to thy son David, my servant's sake, for Jerusalem's sake, which I have chosen. And so what he's saying in effect is that no matter what happens, I'm going to keep the kingdom in your hands, Solomon, until you die. When you die, I'm going to take the kingdom out of the tribe, that is, out of connection with the southern kingdom. I'm going to break up the kingdom. But I am going to keep one tribe, and I'm going to keep the dynasty going. Why? Because of the sacredness of Jerusalem as the capital, but even more important, because of the sacredness of the line, because in that line is going to be the great king of which all of these other kings have simply been a type. David was a type, a preview of Jesus Christ. And so the line has to be kept going, and Jerusalem has to be kept as the capital of the southern kingdom. The city and the line, very important, as you'll see. Well, I think Leon Wood did an excellent job of describing these three adversaries that were stirred up against Solomon. You can read about them in Leon Wood. Hadad from Egypt. Actually, he was an Edomite. I'm sorry. He went down to Egypt. And after David had massacred the Edomites down there, and he caused a problem. And then Hadad came back. Notice in verse 21, when Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his fathers, and that Joab, the captain of the host, was dead, he said, let me depart and go into my own country. So he became a problem. The second one is in verse 23, Rezin, who became leader in Damascus. Damascus is now going to gain in importance, and remember, Damascus is the capital of Syria. As a matter of fact, it still is today, 3,000 years later. Damascus is the capital of Syria. So when it's Damascus, it's like saying Washington. Well, Washington is synonymous, by metonymy, United States. We say London says, Bonn says, Paris says. Well, it's Damascus. Damascus is synonymous with the way of expressing the country. And Syria is now going to become a problem. Jeroboam had a very interesting history. He was in Jerusalem. He was working, actually, for Solomon. There was a problem here. He had to flee to Egypt because the prophecy concerning him became known. And finally, he comes back at just the right, or, depending on how you see it, the wrong time. And so all of these things are working in history, getting ready for the death of Solomon. Hadad is a problem. He doesn't actually figure in history too much right after this. But Rezin does, because Syria now becomes the big threat on the east. Syria becomes the big threat on the east. And Jeroboam comes into the scene, and he is going to be the charismatic leader, the one that's going to take away the hearts of the northern kingdom. He's going to be the man on the spot. I think that's interesting because, to go just a little bit ahead, when the 10 northern tribes broke away, who would be their leader? Would it be somebody from Ephraim? Or somebody from Issachar? They'd have a hard time coming to rest upon one person from any one of the tribes. There would be jealousy. But a man comes on the scene, Jeroboam, who has been closely associated with Solomon, who's been in Jerusalem, who is not identified with any of these tribes. In other words, he's a neutral person, and they can follow him. So there's this counterplot going on in history, getting things ready. And you'll notice that there's a prophecy in the latter part of chapter 11 from Ahijah, a prophecy saying that actually Jeroboam is going to be the head of this northern confederacy, the northern tribes. So it was God's purpose that this be broken up. And that goes back over to chapter 11, verse 13. He says, I'll not take it away from you, but I am going to take it away. So Jeroboam, although he's not a good man, he was used by God in this whole situation. Solomon dies at the end of this chapter, and in chapter 12, the completely new set of characters on the scene. Rehoboam, the son of Solomon was nothing like his father. He acted with extreme lack of wisdom. You know the situation. They said, look, we've been groaning under this taxation all of this time. It was all right while Solomon was here. It almost became unbearable. We waited until he died. Now let's start all over again. We can't afford the taxes that it costs to pay the chariots and the pay for the chariots and the horses, and you're feeding the horses, and we're starving, and we've got this big army. And by the way, if he had all of the wives and so on from the other nations, I don't know why I needed the big army as well, but there was too much for defense. There was too much to run the government. There was too much to buy all of the... Can you imagine how much it cost to feed all the kids, you know, in the palace, and all of the wives, 1,000 wives, you know? Just fantastic. There's a verse there that tells you how much it is. It's just astounding. And the people were just poor. And they said, let's do something about this. Well, Rehoboam does the wrong thing. He sounds like Pharaoh, doesn't he? He says, lay it on all the harder. You thought you had it bad under my father. I'm going to show you. Well, of course, that is the straw that breaks the camel's back. And they're up at Shechem. And I think it's important to notice that Rehoboam goes up to Shechem to meet with these northern tribes. Shechem was in the middle of the country. At least he made that concession. And as Leon Wood points out, normally this would take place in Jerusalem, the capital. It was an unheard of thing to go up to Shechem to have some kind of a consultation with all the tribes. But he goes up there, and it doesn't work out. And we find in verse 15, the cause was from the Lord. That's important. The king didn't hearken to the people, for the cause was from the Lord. In other words, Rehoboam did the dumb thing he did because that was going to bring about what God had purposed in history for this breakup of the kingdom. The cause was from the Lord. And then in 12:16, we find this famous cry. They say, what portion have we in David? In other words, what's David got to offer us? Why should we follow the line of David? To your tents, O Israel. In other words, this is revolt. Let's go. Give me liberty or give me death. Taxation without representation is tyranny and all that sort of thing. Well, I shouldn't say those in the same sentence because the causes were somewhat different. But taxes seem to have quite an effect on history, however you look at it. And this is the division of the kingdom in chapter 12, right after Solomon's death. And as a matter of fact, they decide whether they're going to fight it out right then. Naturally, they think, well, each side thinks they're going to fight. But in verse 24, the Lord says, you shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing is from me. So verse 24 is an echo of verse 15. He allowed it to happen because it was of the Lord. He would not allow Rehoboam with Judah to go up and fight it because this thing is from me. This is my plan. This is something that's difficult for us to face in history sometimes, that a nation that we are associated with or that we particularly like or people we like or a group we like will come into a period of suffering. And we would naturally say, well, God, you can't let this happen to them. And if ever in history anybody would say rightly, you can't let this happen to Judah, while this is the tribe of David, this is where the capital is, you can't let them break off like that, Lord. You can't let them do this. You can't let this rebellion go on. And yet in that long-range view of God, it had to take place. The climax of this, the crowning event of the incident of this, is in 586 B.C. And all through the ministry of Jeremiah, Jeremiah said that Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonians, are going to come in and they're going to take the city of Jerusalem. Now, don't fight. They say they can't take Jerusalem. There's no way. You mean that somebody, that God, our God, is going to allow somebody to knock down that temple of Solomon? With all that gold and all that fine work, it can't be. It'll never happen. It can't happen here. Because that's God's temple. That's where the ark is. This is Jerusalem. This is the capital city. It can't happen here. And if ever there seemed to be a right cause, it was the cause of Judah, both at this time in 931 B.C. and 586 B.C. But in each case, the good didn't happen. The bad happened. And Nebuchadnezzar did come down and did take them away. My point is this, that we may see suffering in situations where we would logically think it shouldn't come. I guess the extension of this, although it's not parallel because those people were evil, most of them were, but the extension of this is even the righteous suffer. And we'll get to the book of Job. The righteous sometimes suffer, And the unrighteous don't always suffer. And so logic has to be made submissive to God's overall plan. We see a good illustration of this. Well, the only other thing we need to notice in chapter 12 is how Jeroboam set up his government. And he was at Shechem, and that's right in the middle of the West Bank, still is today. By the way, as you know, Shechem is just about a couple of miles or less than that from the city of Nablus today, and that's the key center in the West Bank and the interactions today. And then he also built, right across the Jordan River, about equal distance on the other side of the Jordan River, Penuel. Remember, around the brook Jabbok. So it looked like he was building a center on each side. But then he realized, in verse 28, he realized that the big problem was Jerusalem. His biggest single problem in establishing his rule over the northern tribes was that they were in the habit of going down to Jerusalem every year, three times a year, to worship. And if they went down to Jerusalem to worship, they were going down to the capital, what had been the capital of the whole United Kingdom. And if they went down there, then they were in danger of losing loyalty to him. It was all right to say to your tents, O Israel, we're not going to pay taxes. But when the emotions all cooled down, and if they kept on going up to Jerusalem, he was afraid he would lose his hold on them. So he did a kind of a smart and dumb thing. He put an altar at Bethel. The problem with Bethel was that it was on the way to Jerusalem, and it would cut them off so that they'd just come as far as Bethel and worship. That was the good part, strategy-wise. But the bad part was it was too close to Jerusalem. So he put an altar, a worship center, at Bethel in the south so that he'd cut them off at the pass. In other words, they'd get down to Bethel. You don't have to go any farther. Worship here. Don't go on down to Jerusalem. Bethel, just 12 miles north of Jerusalem. And then he put another worship center with a golden calf. I wonder where he got that idea. Where had he been for some years? In Egypt. So this was a replay of Exodus 32. He got it directly from Egypt, this one. And he put it up at Dan, up in the north. So he tried to put two worship centers right down near the southern border and right up near the northern border so that they would attract the people and keep them from going down to Jerusalem. God was very displeased with this, and a prophecy is made here and signs given to reinforce the prophecy, to validate it, that one day, in the days of a king, Josiah, that this altar was to be knocked down by a miracle. And this, of course, is fulfilled in 2 Kings 23, verses 15 and 16. You might want to just put it in there. 2 Kings 23, verses 15 and 16 records the very exact fulfillment of this prophecy. At the end of this chapter 13, verse 33, we find the evaluation of Jeroboam. He returned not from his evil way, but made again of the lowest of the people priests of the high places. You remember that priests were only to come from the Levites? Apparently, most of the Levites had centered around Jerusalem, even though theoretically they're spread out all over the country. Their loyalty was still to Jerusalem. And he made priests of the lowest of people, and this thing was a sin under the house of Jeroboam. Chapter 14, we find some sickness in the family and how he dies and so on. And in verse 21, we pick up the story of the southern kingdom. Now, you've got a problem here in the record of trying to keep all these kings straight. And this course is too short to ever try to get you to sort out all these kings. All I'm asking you to do is to know some of the main ones. I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 or 9 of the main ones, and whether they're southern kingdom or northern kingdom. And I'll point particularly to them. And don't think that you have to learn all of them. But we do need to know whether they're in the northern kingdom or the southern kingdom. And the problem here in the record is that it switches back and forth. Two or three chapters will be for the southern kingdom, then part for the northern kingdom, and they'll be jumping back and forth. But in verse 21 of chapter 14, we pick up the story of Rehoboam. Notice verse 22, "And Judah did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins which they committed above all that their fathers had done. For they built them high places and images and groves on every high hill and under every green tree." And that, of course, was the characteristic of idolatry and Baal worship. They worshipped in the groves. They worshipped in the trees on the top of the hills. Now I can understand why Jeroboam's kingdom would do that, because they didn't have Jerusalem, they didn't have the temple. But do you see the irony of it? The one tribe that had the temple, the one tribe that was centered around Jerusalem, the one tribe that had access to the one place of worship in the temple, was the tribe that particularly went out to the hillsides and made these other worship centers. They were following exactly what Solomon had brought in, a high price to pay. And just as a little illustration of how weak they became, in verse 25, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he paid them quite an insult. He didn't take the city of Jerusalem. He just went into the king's treasure house, and he took away all the shields of gold. These were battle shields. They're made of gold. They're more or less ceremonial. And they were in the treasure house at Jerusalem, and they were all around the walls. He just walked in, took down all the gold ones, and put up some plastic ones. Oh, no, some brass ones. So that every time they looked at the brass ones, think, where are the gold? The gold ones are down in Egypt. And what he was doing is just, you know, rubbing their nose in the dirt sort of thing. He didn't have the power to take them over. But he was, in effect, saying, look, I can do whatever I like to in Jerusalem. You can't, and nobody can say him no. And there was war, verse 30, between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, obviously, as you'd expect in that first generation. In chapter 15, verse 11, Asa did that which is right in the sight of the Lord, as did David his father. Here's a good illustration of how the word father is used in Hebrew to indicate an ancestor. Obviously, David wasn't his physical father, but he was his father in the family sense. And once again, this is an illustration of if they did good, it was in the as did David the father. If they did bad, it was in the ways of Jeroboam. Verse 14, the high places were not removed. Still a problem. Syria in verse 18 becomes a problem, so that you have Egypt on the south and you've got Syria on the northeast, and they paid tribute up to Damascus, took treasures out of the king's house and delivered them by the hand of his servants. The king Asa did. He sent them up to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabriman, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, that dwelt in Damascus. And they said, look, we want to be friends. And so this was a payoff, one of the early payoffs in history. Chapter 16, we'll just skip over into the last of chapter 16. The first big king of Israel, that is Israel, the northern kingdom, is important, is Omri. Verse 23, Omri. So the only two kings that we need to really notice thus far in the northern kingdom are Jeroboam, the first one, and Omri, who was sometime later. And Omri was noted for two things. One, he built a capital for the northern kingdom, and the capital was at Samaria. And Samaria was a city, a capital that he personally built. It wasn't there before. Don't confuse this with the woman of Samaria. Samaria was a city in the Old Testament built by Omri, and the capital was established there by his son Ahab. Actually, Omri more or less just got the property and got it started, and Ahab did most of the building. That was destroyed in 722. But the area around there in the intertestamental period came to be called Samaria. And in the New Testament, it is simply a region. The Samaritans were a people who lived in the area of Samaria. But Samaria was not a city in the New Testament. That's why the woman at the well was near Sychar. So there's no such city as Samaria in the New Testament, but it's the name of a region, which obviously came from Samaria being the capital in that area in the Old Testament period. And they got the name Samaria because they bought it from a farmer named Shemer. Shemer. And the Hebrew consonants here are simply adjusted a bit. The vowels are adjusted to make it Samaria. And so it says of verse 25, Omri wrought evil in the eyes of the Lord and did worse than all that were before him. You'll notice he walked in all the way of Jeroboam. So here again is that standard. Jeroboam was the standard for evil. Well, he died and he had a son Ahab. And in verse 28, we begin the life of Ahab, and that takes us right through to the last of the book of 1 Kings. Ahab becomes the important king, and he's one king that you should really note, very, very evil. David?
You said there were two main things about Omri. The first thing was to build a capital. What was the second
thing? Oh, sorry. First one is that he built a capital, and the second one is the father of Ahab. I didn't name it. The father of Ahab. In other words, we associate with him with Ahab. He set the stage, I guess we'd say, for Ahab's reign, and Ahab's reign was very evil, very significant. Omri, yes. Omri built the capital for the northern kingdom. They hadn't had a capital before that. And that had these centers at Bethel. He built up Samaria, he built up Shechem. Shechem, incidentally, is about 9 miles from Samaria. If you go straight north of Jerusalem, you've got Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. You know what I'm talking about? Remember those smiling mountains on the map? Okay. Well, just to the right of them, just at the where the two split, just to the right of them is Shechem. You go between them and turn northwest and go up the road a bit, and you come to Samaria. You can go there today. It's called Sebasti today. Nobody lives there, except there's a small Arab settlement there, a few houses, a few families. But it later became a very big city. Alexander built on it, and it was a Greek city and so on since then. But they have actually excavated the walls and the many of the buildings of this particular time of Ahab's day. You can go there today and see the very place, probably the very place where Ahab stood and defied Elijah defied Ahab and told him it wasn't going to rain and so on. The whole scene is laid out there. And it's an amazing place. It's on the top of a big hill. I hesitate to call it a mountain or you'll think it has snow on it, but it's a big hill. And you can walk around on that thing. It takes you probably 45 minutes or an hour to walk around sort of the perimeter of that hill, kind of like a saucer, or kind of like a cup upside down with a rim around. You can walk around that, and you can look in every direction and see valleys before you get to the hills. Marvelous for fortification. So keep that in mind as a background of this, that you're on a big hill, oh, big enough, I guess, for a quarter of the city of Columbia to be built there. Maybe not quite that big, but it's a big hill. But the point is that as you go around there, you could see the enemy coming from any direction. And, of course, they look mostly to the northeast, toward Damascus, toward Syria. And eventually, when the Assyrians came down, they took Damascus in 732, and then they came, and it took them 3 years to take the city of Samaria, and they destroyed it. And that was the end of the northern kingdom, which we'll get to in a little bit. Okay, it's very interesting how God brings on this terrible king Ahab, and then he brings Elijah along. So the rest of this book, from chapter 17 on, is really the conflict between Elijah and Ahab. We've been going along at a fast pace in terms of not very much said about each king. We worked through several families, zip, 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 through 10, 20, 50 years, just going right through. All of a sudden, boom, we slow down and put the zoom lens on one king and one prophet. So we're getting a bit of detail. You wanted the Lord to slow down so that you could get a good hold on this age and see what God was doing. Well, this is what he's doing. So we go in slow motion now. Through the rest of the book, at least as far as the record is concerned. Verse 30, two things he did in verse 16 we need to notice. In verse 31, he marries Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, the king of the Zidonians. Well, that didn't help the theological climate of the northern kingdom. And then in verse 33, he makes a grove, and Ahab did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel to anger than all the kings of Israel that were before him. And the third thing he did here was they built Jericho. It's interesting that the northern kingdom goes down to Jericho. They have control of that. You'd think that the southern kingdom would have control of Jericho, but they didn't, because that's way down in the south. But the curve of the border just went up and included Jericho in the northern kingdom. This is a fulfillment, by the way, of Joshua 6:26, because in Joshua 6:26, the prophecy was made that the sons of the man that rebuilt Jericho, when Joshua took it, those sons would die, and that's exactly what happened. It was fulfilled here. Well, Elijah comes on the scene. Elijah the Tishbite. Do you have your map on that? Can you? If you look at the map on 1st and 2nd Kings 6, you'll see the career of Elijah, and of course the career of Elisha as well. I thought these maps might help you to think your way through where these events took place. Elijah apparently comes from over near that brook Kereth, about where the two is on your map. It's approximately where his hometown was. And he is sent over to Samaria, which is one, and the reason it's one is because that's the first action that he's involved in. And he comes over to predict that there's going to be a drought. As we've seen, this is the classic judgment of God upon idolatry. So here is confrontation. Chapters 17 and 18 are solid confrontation between God and Satan in the persons of Elijah and Ahab. Clear-cut division. Each knew exactly where the other would stand. And the prediction is there that as the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. Now, often they didn't have rain, but when they didn't have dew, it was just terrible. Down, I know, at least along the Bethlehem area, they told us that in a year they would get at least 7 inches, the equivalent of 7 inches of rainfall in the dew. And you can go out in the dry season and everything is just wet. I remember, well, it was south of this, but I remember going out in the middle of the night once and accidentally touching a tree, and I thought it just started to pour rain in the middle of the night. The dew is very, very heavy. But without dew and without any rain for all this period of time, it was going to be a terrible experience. God was going to teach him something. Well, what's Elijah going to do? Well, he goes back by the brook Kereth, which is probably, by the way, it's located several places by different commentators and so on, but most of them would agree that it's over here as you see it on your map. He goes over there. The ravens feed him. By the way, God has interesting ways of feeding Elijah, and as far as I know, he didn't complain about any of the food. He got first fed by the birds, and second, he got fed by a widow, and he worked his way up, and the third time, he was fed by an angel. And in each case, God met his need. Well, there's no rain. Then God says, go on up to Zarephath. Very interesting thing about this story. I'm sure you're familiar with it. He comes up and finds a widow in Zarephath. That would immediately put her into a poverty-stricken situation because she had no one to provide for her. And this is one of those painful, pitiful scenes almost. When he gets there, he says, fetch me a little water in a vessel that I may drink. Bring me a little bread. And she says, as the Lord God liveth, I have not a cake, but a handful of meal. I don't have anything to give you. All I've got the fixings. And there's really not of them to give you very much. I was just going to take the last bit we had and make a little bit of food for my son and me. We're going to eat it, and that was it. We're going to die. Now, if you're Elijah, what would you say? Oh, I'm sorry, ma'am. I came to the wrong house. I beg your pardon. I wouldn't take your last food. I'm very embarrassed, and so on. Well, he really had to have inspiration to say this next thing. He says, fear not. You make me a little of the cake first and bring it to me, and after that, you and your son can eat. Now, that goes against every bit of compassion, every bit of gentlemanly or southern hospitality or anything else. This is just against our natures. But God was behind it because God was giving this woman an opportunity to believe. Now, I don't know how far we can really extend this to an application today, but some of you who will be supported by others in a pastoral or missionary situation will from time to time find yourself supplied by people whom you really think that, well, I shouldn't take it from him or her. When we went to Africa, there was a woman whose husband was an alcoholic and had beaten her, gave her a terrible time. Her son and daughter were just a terrible situation. To keep herself alive, she worked as a chambermaid in the Radisson Hotel and worked there all her life with her only money. When we went to go to Africa, she gave us her entire savings of $800. I don't know why. Don't often feel like Elijah, but on that occasion I did. She insisted we take it. Her husband came to the commissioning service, accepted the Lord. They went to, 2 weeks later, we found out in Africa, 2 weeks later they went to do some shopping at a shopping center. She went in to the store, came back out and found him dead of a heart attack over the wheel of his car. And there's a lot more to the story than that. But it was just one of those traumatic things, and I thought of Elijah here. But the thing is, that woman had a glow about her. It meant more to her to give that $800 than to keep it and say, well, how come I've got such a bad husband and only have $800? So this is a trying scene. But anyway, she did it in faith. Talk about seek ye first the kingdom of God and all these things will be added unto you. Here's another illustration of it. The first was Solomon. And he asked for wisdom and got the whole kingdom and got everything. The temple and all the wealth. Here is a woman that all she has to give is the last that she has. And she is rewarded for it. Very dramatic story. And then in chapter 18, Elijah is sent by the Lord back to Ahab. Now, if you're Elijah, how would you like to go back to Ahab after he's been chomping at the bit and been very, very thirsty? People get thirsty for 3.5 years. They can be awfully mean. And he was. He meets this man, Obadiah, no relation to the prophet. And he says, Obadiah, I got to see this man, Ahab. Oh, he says, I'll get in trouble. He goes through this business. He says, and he tries to talk his way out of it. And he says, listen. He says, I'm going to go see him. Well, the big verse that comes out of this is that when Elijah and Ahab get together in verse 17, he says, art thou he that troubleth Israel? Did I hear that right, Ahab? You said it's Elijah? And this is another sort of eternal spiritual principle, that God and his people will get blamed for the sins of people. Don't be surprised if you get blamed for what Satan's doing. Satan doesn't usually take the blame. He tries to put it on somebody else. And in this case, he did. Art thou he that troubleth Israel? And Elijah, he knew the truth. He had perspective on it. He says, I've not troubled Israel, but it's your problem. It's your fault. You're the cause of it. And then they're going to have this big confrontation. In verse 21, Elijah comes to the people and he says, how long will you literally limp between two opinions? Now, this is a crucial passage because this brings into sharp, clear focus on Mount Carmel up there in the jutting out into the Mediterranean Sea over what is now the oil refineries of Haifa. It brings into sharp focus what the whole issue was, that they were vacillating back and forth between the worship of God and the worship of Baal. And this word actually means literally limping. They were limping. It's kind of like in our situation would have one foot walking along the curb and the other foot down below. And, they couldn't decide which way they're going to go. And you know the story of this great confrontation. Just one thing as we end up here, I'd draw to your attention, that when the altar was on, when the fire was set and the animals were on the altar, the issue was, shall we start the fire? Is Baal going to start the fire? Is God going to start the fire? Now, do you remember any one of them could have lit a match? Well, they could have rubbed sticks together and got the thing burning. But the question is, does the fire come down from heaven? You remember that issue? It's not something that comes up from man, but down from heaven. And Baal couldn't do it, and it's kind of a funny story here, about Baal, he's asleep, maybe he's gone on his holidays, maybe he's, it's lunch hour or something, get him back and so on, a little bit of fun there. And then when the fire does come down, it shows the judgment of God, it shows that God is the God. But the thing I want to point your attention to, is that he put water all over the thing. And if I wanted something to burn, I wouldn't put water on it. In other words, he made it as hard as possible for God so that God could do the bigger miracle. And I use this in my own experience quite often. If I have a choice and have to make a decision and I'm not sure which way, I don't deliberately go out and look for trouble. We've done this in some cases, occasions and some administrative things, and I call it putting water on the sacrifice. Just make it real hard for God. In other words, don't take any shortcuts because you never know if you take a shortcut. For instance, if you dried it out, let the sun shine on it. It got fairly dry. Then it caught on fire. Well, it might have been, spontaneous combustion. It might have been something else. But if you put water on it, you know it's God doing it. So don't be afraid to put water in your sacrifice. God wants to start a fire. He doesn't care how much water there is there. Main thing is you have to be talking to the right God. And then he'll answer with fire. Okay, that's it for today. Thank you. If you read and study 1 and 2 Kings, or any of the Old Testament books for that matter, historical books, strictly from a historical standpoint, by that I mean strictly from a horizontal standpoint of events that took place hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, it can be pretty meaningless and irrelevant. But as soon as you get the vertical dimension in this and see that it's the same God dealing there exactly as that deals with us today, the whole thing takes on excitement and just a whole new dimension. At least that's what I find. I was up this morning at about 5:30 reading through some of these passages, and I almost missed my breakfast. I got so excited about what God was doing through these people. This happens to be a particularly exciting period of history that we're studying in terms of miracles and great events and sudden turns of events, and it's evident why the Lord did it through Elijah and Elijah in this way, because there was such a counterattack on Satan's part, really saying, in effect, God isn't there. And the message comes through, he's there, and he's not silent, as Francis Schaeffer would say. And this is an exciting period of history when we realize that although this is nearly 3,000 years removed from us now, in the light of eternity, a million years from now, it'll look like yesterday compared with 1981 or whatever. And so this is an eternal God dealing with people who are eternal people, dealing with them in terms of eternal truth, dealing with them in terms of this great conflict of the ages between God and Satan. So let's not fall into the trap of saying, well, they're way over there on the other side of history from us, and that's not relevant. Let's look at it from the standpoint of eternity and see that they're our next door neighbors, that this is very real, and that this is the same God that's acting. And although he may not make axe heads to swim today, he can do lots of things. And after all, I'm glad that the axe head swam, and I'm glad that the poor guys that borrowed it and lost it and didn't get in trouble. But really, that's minor compared with some of the things that he does in our lives today. And I'm sure that any of those sons of the prophets would have exchanged a mailbox experience for just an axe head or some of these events. And so it's the same God working through history. And if he doesn't need to do certain miracles with us, it's not because he can't. And it's not because we're inferior. It's just because he doesn't need to in this particular situation. He's working in us in other ways. Now, before we move farther into 1 Kings, I do want to go back over and just reinforce what you have in your notes. I know it's before you, but in Solomon's reign on 1 Kings 3, page 3, notice his domestic policies. He was an absolute monarch. He perfected the government organization. He had a powerful standing army with chariots, and he built the temple. These are the four big things. His absolute reign as a monarch. He was not democratic like his father David had been. David had started an excellent organization of the kingdom, the structure of government. He perfected it. In fact, he honed it up so that it was pretty sharp for people. They got kind of cut by it in places, especially that taxation thing. And then he did something as a father had not done. David had the army rotating in, the home guard, so to speak, the National Guard, as we saw. But Solomon was the first one to have a standing army and have it with chariots. So he had a mechanized division, and he paid them 12 months a year. It cost a lot more. As a matter of fact, he didn't need them half as much as his father David did. They were kind of superfluous, but they didn't have a Senate or a House of Congress to cut down on military spending at that time. And then he built the temple in Jerusalem. Of course, that was his crowning thing. And in his foreign policy, two big things: alliances by marriage and extensive trade and commerce. Now, turn the page for a moment to the comparison of the two kingdoms. This is when they broke up. And this is a sort of a description and dimension that many people do not at first realize. And as we work through the prophets and the kings of the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, I want you to be aware and have a clear impression in your mind as to the kind of people we're dealing with, the kind of world in which they lived. The northern kingdom was called Israel, We call it obviously northern and southern just for convenience, but the scripture usually calls them Israel and Judah, sometimes Ephraim and Judah. The area of the northern kingdom was five times larger than that of Judah, and the land was much more fertile. The reason for that is you had the area around Dothan, you had the plain of Esdraelon, you had the plain of Jezreel, that big cut that comes through from Mount Carmel across to the Jordan Valley. You had much of the Jordan Valley up there. You had some of the land along the seacoast, although the Philistines were powerful quite a ways north. But there were many good fertile valleys, whereas down in Judah, you had mostly mountains. They grew grapes, they had sheep. You remember that David was a shepherd and so on, and you had mostly animal husbandry down there, but you did not have the fertile plains. The population of the northern kingdom was three times greater. It may strike as strange that it was only three times greater, but Judah was a very, very big tribe, and that's why that proportion. Their military strength was far superior, and we would consider their cause to be just. In other words, why did they actually split? They wanted relief from taxes. It was a tax issue that really was the trigger that split the northern kingdom off. And so we'd say, well, boy, we don't blame those guys for going up there. We wouldn't want to pay the kind of taxes that Rehoboam was trying to lay on them. Their government, notice they had 19 kings and none of them was good or righteous. So that was a bit of a hazard. And they had 9 dynasties. In other words, 9 changes of royal families. So that wasn't all that great for continuity. Their spiritual condition from Jeroboam, their first king, right on through, it was just a stream of idolatrous people. There was never a real revival in the northern kingdom. There was never really a walk with God. And that, incidentally, is why I think that God sent Elijah and Elisha to the northern kingdom. They ministered to the northern kingdom because that's where the greatest need was. In contrast, in the southern kingdom, they had the capital, they had Jerusalem, which was the religious and civil center. And as time went on, of course, their religious ceremonies became very very empty. But nevertheless, they did have the temple. They had, among their kings, they had 8 righteous kings, and 5 of them led revivals, real revivals. As a matter of fact, the last one to do this was Josiah. And he came to the throne as, very young. And he actually was a teenager when he led his revival. So they had some good kings. And they only had one dynasty all the way through. It was always the line of David. And of course, that was a promise to David that there would never be, there would always be somebody in his family on the throne. In chapter 18, we see the strong confrontation between God and Baal. And this is worked out between Elijah and the prophets of Baal. God doesn't always bring about a confrontation like this, but there was a reason for it. You remember my theory of this big visual aid thing? And here's another one of these massive visual aids. What could be more convincing than to get 400 prophets of Baal up on Mount Carmel? Now, Mount Carmel is that little peninsula that juts out. In fact, as you come down the coastline, just below Tyre and Sidon and Tyre, you come to a little bay in there, and there's a little area that juts out. And the reason it juts out is it kind of has a backbone of Mount Carmel. It's obviously still there today, a really beautiful place. You get up on there, you can look way out over the Mediterranean. And as a matter of fact, you can stand back on Mount Moron, which, as you know, is just northwest of the Sea of Galilee. You can stand there, as we did not too long ago, and look straight across, and you can see the university on the top of Mount Carmel today. And so it's a very high mountain. I don't mean, once again, like something in the Rockies, but it was a high mountain. And they didn't have water right up there. They had to bring water from certain springs, and they show you today where this water was brought for the sacrifice and so on. So this was literally a high visibility place. The brook Kishon goes along right at the base of it. And in this confrontation, the people were challenged to, for once and for all, either follow God or Baal. And of course, God spoke from heaven in a dramatic way, and the fire came down on the soggy, sopping wet sacrifice and burned it to a crisp just like that. Well, that was a theological pronouncement, a theological statement that the prophets of Baal did not recover from. And they were to be taken down by the brook Kishon and killed. And then the way had been cleared for rain to come. Remember, it hadn't rained for 3.5 years. That was the urgent matter, this drought. And so this is the occasion, as you know, where Elijah on Mount Carmel goes out to the point and looks over there and sends his servant over to check to see if there's any rain coming. And that's how it came. It always came from the Mediterranean Sea. The westerlies would bring it in, and no clouds had come in there for 3.5 years. And now he looks out and he sees a cloud the size of a man's hand. Just a little cloud. First cloud I've seen in 3.5 years. Before that cloud really grew fast, because before they could get very far back down off the mountain and along toward Jezreel, the rains had come, thunderstorm, and they just, you've seen this kind of thing happen. Just the heavens open up after a long drought, and poor old Ahab had trouble getting back to Jezebel. If I were Ahab, I'd rather be stuck in my chariot in the mud than get back to Jezebel. But she was back there, and she was furious when she heard all of this. And this is the failure, as Leon Wood points out, a real failure on the part of Elijah. Because although he had been able to face up to the 400 prophets of Baal, he was afraid of what Jezebel might do to him. There's a real lesson in this that each one of us has probably experienced and will certainly need to be encouraged on again and again, that it almost seems to be without exception that whenever we have a great spiritual victory, there is always kind of a letdown after it. There's just kind of a letdown. We build ourselves up and we see God do something great, and then we fear. You see, Elijah's trouble was really he lost faith. In other words, he stopped believing God. He could believe God to call on him to send down the fire on that sacrifice, but he couldn't believe God to look after Jezebel. And I don't know about you, but this is my problem. I can believe him for some things, and great things happen. And then just maybe some lesser thing. I just sort of can't, well, he can't take care of that. He can take care of the sacrifice. He can take care of the 400 prophets of Baal, but Jezebel's a bit too much for him. Now, that's evidence in the fact that he ran away. Because if he thought God could handle Jezebel, he would have stayed up there. Well, Jezebel, what are you going to say about that, huh? Where are your prophets now? Why don't you repent, Jezebel? You've lost it all. Your God isn't any good. He can't answer. In other words, it's just to stand up to Jezebel. But he didn't. Well, let's not be too hard on him. It could happen to any of us. And he takes off and goes away down to the south country. And before it's ended, he gets all the way down, of all places, down to Mount Sinai, which is Horeb. And this is in chapter 19. Well, he goes down there quite a ways, and finally he's tired. And like the prophet Jeremiah, a couple of hundred years later, in verse 4, he requests for himself that he might die. He got so discouraged. He had such a victory. I'm sure that today, if most of us had that experience, we would go to a publisher and say, hey, I'm going to write a book on how I beat the 400 prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, you know? Give me a contract. Will you offer me for it? But he was depressed. He just says, Lord, I want to die. I just can't go on. I just can't live up to it. And I think that some of us have this experience too. We have a great spiritual experience and something the Lord really uses us in some way. Then I guess we kind of feel like Peter out there in the water, you know? All of a sudden, we start to sink. Hey, what am I doing out here? I'm beyond my depth, literally. Beyond my depth, I'm out in the limb. It's okay so far, but he can't keep it up. You preach a great message, and people say that was tremendous, and 20 people come down to the front. What am I going to preach next Sunday, you know? What am I going to do in prayer meeting? What am I going to do in the evening service, you know? What am I going to do when I go home and my wife says, hey, that wasn't such a great sermon. You put in too many uhs or whatever. But Anyway, there's that letdown. And that's when we need to just say, all right, Lord, now I'm not going to do like Elijah did. I'm not going to do like he did. I believe that you're the God that can take care of me down here. So it's quite a story from Mount Carmel to Mount Sinai for him. But he gets down there, and God's gracious to him, and he knows he's tired. And this is a point, too, is that he was just dead tired, physically tired, and he had to sleep it off. Sometimes what we take as being spiritual failure is really just plain physical tiredness. Get a good night's sleep, and things look a lot different. Sometimes we have to stay up and talk something through 2 o'clock in the morning, but my experience is that after about 10 o'clock, maybe I'm just getting old, but after about 10 o'clock, it's better to wait till the next morning. God isn't in that much of a hurry, and things do look brighter in the morning. we can get better perspective on some problem we have. Just take it until the morning. But anyway, that doesn't apply to studying for exams. The angels come and feed him, which is kind of a nice touch because, as we saw yesterday, God had fed him through the ravens. And he didn't know he was going to end up being fed by these angels. They had lots of food, by the way. They weren't running out of it like the poor woman up at Zarephath. And Elijah gets down there, and God reveals himself. He asks him in verse 9, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And that's a question that ought to ring in our ears. What are you doing here, wherever we are? Am I in the right place at the right time? Sometimes I've had that experience. What on earth am I doing here? I shouldn't be here. What are you doing here? You ought to be up there at Jezreel or someplace where the action's going on. Anyway, he was gracious to him. Again in verse 13, "What doest thou here, Elijah?" And of course, Elijah, to jump on a bit, Elijah thinks he's the only one. He says, "Well, I'm the only one left." He says, "No, you're not." In verse 18, "God knew that there were 7,000 in Israel," that's in the northern kingdom, 7,000, that was the moral minority, I guess, 7,000 up there that hadn't bowed their knee to Baal. I didn't know there were 7,000. Yeah, 7,000? 7,000 of them. Hey, that's quite a group. That's enough to start a denomination. There's 7,000 people. Well, that's good. I'm glad that I'm not the only one. So they weren't coming out of the woodwork very far, but they were up there anyway. And then he gives them three commissions in verses 15 and 16. He was going to be an international figure. Look at this. He's going to announce, he was going to anoint the next king of Syria. Syria, that's their enemy. And Jehu, he was going to anoint the man who was just a nobody, who was to become the leader, the first of the next dynasty of the king of the monarchy in Israel, the northern kingdom. And that Jehu, incidentally, was going to knock off the line of Ahab. And then he was going to anoint Elisha. So he's going to anoint the next king of Syria. He's going to anoint the next king of Israel, and he was going to anoint his successor. So that's a pretty important commission. Okay, in chapter 20, we find the strong rule of Ahab recorded, the beginning of this strong rule, and we find the beginning of a long conflict between Ahab, the king of the northern kingdom, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria. And Elijah figures prominently in this all the way through. Ahab is a wicked king, but nevertheless, God does use him and does strengthen him for various battles. You'll notice in verse 4, he says, "My Lord, O king, according to thy saying, I am thine and all that I have." There's a real commitment here for battle. And then in verse 13, God promises victory to Ahab. "There came a prophet unto Ahab, king of Israel, saying, Thus saith the Lord, Hast thou seen this great multitude? I will deliver it into thine hand even this day, and thou shalt know that I am the Lord." And old Ahab says, "Who's going to do this again now?" And he says, "Well, the young men are the princes of the province." "Well, who's going to lead them?" "You're going to lead them." "Me?" "Yes." And so God is here establishing his sovereign desire and power to help the northern kingdom to withstand the attacks and the conflict with Syria. And so Ahab wins this victory. And then in verse 22, there's a warning here to Ahab. He says, "Go strengthen thyself and mark and see what thou doest, for at the return of the year the king of Syria will come against thee." In other words, the battle isn't over yet, and there are going to be a series of three battles against the Assyrians, with Ahab fighting against them. The first one he beat them, but he says he's going to come back before the year's ended, and you are supposed to wipe him out. Now the problem is that Ahab, just like Saul with the Amalekites, Ahab did not kill the king. And so Ben-Hadad was a problem to him ever after this. Down in verse 20, we find victory. The children of Israel slew the Syrians and 100,000 footmen in one day. There's a very interesting dimension to this battle. The Israelites, as you know, had won the first battle fighting in the uplands, in the hills, in the mountains. And somehow the word got to the Assyrians that God could take care of his people as long as they had the advantage of the hill. But if ever they had to fight down in the plains, in the flat parts of Galilee, that they couldn't win. And God wasn't going to just take that without responding to it. And he says, we're going to beat them again, and this time we're going to beat them down in the valleys. And this wonderful phrase keeps coming back. He's not only the God of the mountains, but he's the God of the valleys as well. Now, if you want to spiritualize Scripture, there's a marvelous place to do some spiritualizing, you know. But if you have, this is in verse 28 and following. If you have an experience that you think that God led you through in a powerful way, but there were some good circumstances and everything was working right, and then you get in a place where it doesn't seem to come out right, and there seems to be everything against you, you think he can't work in this. Remember that he can work in the mountains, he can work in the valleys. The point is that militarily, if you're up in the highlands, you've got an advantage. If you're in the valleys and the plains, you've got a disadvantage. And even when everything is against you, God can win the battle. Now, in beginning at verse 5, we find that Ahab sinned by sparing Ben-Hadad. He should have killed him, but he didn't. And this was a real problem. Notice verse 42. Thus saith the Lord, because thou hast let go out of thy hand a man whom I appointed to utter destruction, therefore thy life shall go for his life, and thy people for his people. This sounds a lot like 1 Samuel 15. It's exactly what happened to Saul. You might say, well, wasn't he just being gracious? What about Ahab? Maybe he was just kind. Why should he be judged for having let Ben-Hadad go? Because Ben-Hadad was an evil man. Sometimes in this life, God judges evil. Sometimes he doesn't. Ultimately, all evil will be judged. Ultimately, the books will all be balanced up. But when God determines in certain situations to judge a person in this life, when God determines that in this life judgment's to come, then he very often does it through individuals, especially in the Old Testament period. And when he calls on one of his people, whether it's Samuel or David or Ahab or whoever, to be the instrument in that judgment, and here's the key to it, that individual does not have the right or the authority to act like a Supreme Court and reverse God's decision. And that's actually what he did. He said, I'm not going to kill him for whatever reasons. I'm not going to kill him. So he was in effect reversing the judgment that God had determined to come on Ben-Hadad. And that was his sin. Now, I don't think that today that God is going to put us in this kind of situation. I guess the closest we would probably come to this in practice today is if God is wanting to get through to a person, wanting to, maybe with a believer for that matter, to get through to a believer in rebuke of some kind or edification of some kind, and we say, Lord, who am I to talk to that person? You know, he's as good as I am, and I'm not perfect myself, and I'm not going to lay anything on him, probably because we don't want anything laid on ourselves. And we're, in a sense, saying, well, God, I'm not going to act as your agent because I don't think it's a good thing to do. And so it's important that we be available to God and let him use us. Maybe not like he wanted to use Ahab in this judgment situation to bring death, capital punishment on this man, but at least that we be available and don't countermand him. You'll notice the result in verse 43. He was heavy and displeased. Ahab was a temperamental person. His emotions got the better of him. Now, when a leader gets heavy and displeased, when he gets out of sorts, when he knows he's done something wrong, when there's sin in his life, when there's disobedience in his life, then anything can happen. And I want you to notice that what happened in chapter 21 was probably a direct outcome of the attitude that came in these previous verses. I'm sure you've had this experience too, that, well, maybe you haven't. Maybe you never really disobey the Lord and feel that you're guilty. But I know that if I've done something wrong or spoken harshly to somebody or thought something or told a lie or something like that, or really done something that nothing goes right sort of thing, and I very easily get angry with people. Have you ever had that? When you're upset within yourself? And you just kind of lose contact with reality. And everything gets distorted. And nice people are bad people, or they've got it in for me, and so on. You know, grizzly. And he became grizzly. Why? Because he was heavy and displeased. Why? Because he knew he had disobeyed God. And the result was that for no reason at all, he sees his neighbor, Naboth, with this nice little vineyard, and he says, I want your vineyard. He said, I won't give it to you. He said, I'll buy it from you. No, he said, you can't buy it from me. Why, this is my inheritance. Notice how precious the land was to them. He says, no, I can't give it up. This is my family inheritance. I can't give this up to you. He says, oh, gotta have it. No, you can't have it. So what does he do? He goes home and sulks. And in verse 4, he laid him down in his bed, turned away his face, and would eat no bread. How old did you say he was? 8 years old? He's acting like a kid. And of course, his suave, sophisticated wife sashays in her high heels and her earrings dangling and says, what's the matter, Ahab? You know, he won't give me that vineyard next door. Easy matter, husband. What's the matter with you? You're the king of Israel. You can do what you want. Take it. And so she fixed this thing up like nothing. She just had a big feast day and had him there and had a couple of prophets of Baal say that he had blasphemed God. Isn't that something? Prophets of Baal saying that this poor guy Naboth had blasphemed Jehovah? That doesn't make any sense at all. They said, oh, he's blasphemed Jehovah. We've got to, you know, no evidence, but we've got to stone him. So they stone him to death. Poor Naboth is dead. Ahab gets his vineyard and everybody lives happily ever after. No. Elijah enters the scene, verse 17. In verse 19 he says, hast thou killed and also taken possession? And he says, in the place where the dogs lick the blood of Naboth, the dogs shall lick thy blood, even thine. 1 Kings 22:38, it's fulfilled. The dogs literally lick his blood. And Ahab says, have you found me, O mine enemy? He always thinks that Elijah is his enemy. And he says, I found you because you've sold yourself to work evil in the sight of God. And then, of course, not only he is going to have this situation, but the dogs are going to lick up the blood of Jezebel, and that will be fulfilled as well. 1 Kings 9:36 fulfills verse 23. It actually happens. Verse 25 is a key verse. None like unto Ahab that did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel, his wife, stirred up. Ahab had to have enough problems, but if he ever slowed down in his evil, he had a power, dynamic powerhouse behind him in the person of Jezebel. She got him into more trouble. He couldn't really blame her, though. Chapter 22, there's some peace between the two countries, but chapter 22 is interesting because Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, now enters the scene. And no longer is the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom fighting each other. Jehoshaphat enters the scene, and they're trying to decide as to whether or not they should go up and fight again. And they get some prophets, and they say, hey, should we go up and fight these Syrians again? And the answer is, yeah, go up, you can beat them. He says, well, isn't there, Jehoshaphat isn't settled with that, isn't satisfied with that. In verse 8 he says, there's yet one man, Micah, by whom we may inquire of the Lord. But I hate him, for he doth not prophesy good concerning me, but evil. And he says, you want a true prophet? Yeah, we want a true prophet. Well, I know one guy that tells the truth, but I don't like what he says, because whatever he says, it goes against me. Nevertheless, we'll get him. And so Micah comes up, and they press him on the matter. And there's a beautiful combination here. I want you to catch it. We don't have time to read these verses, verses 13 to 17. But what happens here is that Micah says, go up and fight them. Well, now, were they to win? No. They were to go up and fight them because God was going to use Ben-Hadad to judge Ahab. And so he was sent up to battle because God was going to deal with him in the battle. But then the question is, what about the people? And how is this expressed in verse 17? That's the key prophecy. In verse 17, I saw all Israel scattered upon the hills as sheep that have not a shepherd. Who's the shepherd of the sheep at that time? King Ahab. And so what's it saying in effect? The people are going to get out of this, but the king isn't. And that was kind of a veiled way of expressing it. And that's what actually happens. Because in the battle, in verse 29, when they go up to Ramoth-Gilead, Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, went up to Ramoth-Gilead, and the king of Israel, that's Ahab, And he says, listen, he says, I think they got it in for me. I'm kind of afraid in this thing. God told me to kill Ben-Hadad, and I didn't, and I know I'm in trouble. And if I go up and fight there, I'm going to be very vulnerable. So I tell you what I'm going to do. Jehoshaphat, that's the king of the southern kingdom with him. He says, you dress like a king. That's kind of a dirty trick. He says, you dress like a king. But he says, I'm just going to dress like an ordinary old guy. So he goes up there in his old, in his grubbies and his fatigues, you know. And he says, they'll never spot me as a king, you know. There's nothing. I just look like one of the ordinary soldiers. And they go up there, and of course, it's not really funny. But the Syrians come tearing down on the army. They see Jehoshaphat with all his robes and so on. Hey, get him. There's the king. Jehoshaphat says, not me. I'm not the king. And so they leave him alone, and he doesn't get killed. But some guy just thwing with an arrow, didn't even aim the thing. Comes right down and hits Ahab in a vital spot, and he dies. Now, if that isn't an argument for predestination, I don't know what is. And the result was, notice down in verse 31, at the end of the verse, fight neither with small nor great, save or except only with the king of Israel. So the order was, don't kill the people, just get the king. And that's exactly what the prophecy had said. And down in verse 36, at the end of the verse, every man to his city and every man to his country. So the king died. So the people didn't get hurt, but the king certainly did. And then you'll notice the prophecy of Ahab fulfilled. So the king died, verse 37, verse 38, the dogs licked up his blood from off the chariot. He had a son who reigned briefly. Ahaziah reigned for a couple of years. And then he had another son, Jehoram. And this other son is the one that is prominent throughout the life of Elisha from here on in. By the way, Ahaziah had a very undignified death. Apparently leaned too far out the window one day and fell down onto the screen or the lattice work down on the patio and injured himself and wondered whether he's going to recover or not. And out of that, this little scene develops in the first chapter of 2 Kings. The essence of this is that when he wanted to know what his future was, he sent down of all people, of all places, he sent down to Baalzebub, that's a good name, Baalzebub down in Ekron amongst the Philistines to get the information. He didn't ask God. He asked down there. God intervened, as you know, in a very dramatic way, and he sent Elijah down in the middle of the thing and cut him off at the pass, killed a number of men, and the result was that the king actually died. Well, this brings us very close to the end of the ministry of Elijah. And chapter 2, of course, is an important chapter because this is the transition from Elijah to Elisha. A scene which is often preached on as the mantle of Elijah fell onto Elisha. But there's a bit of background there that I hope you haven't missed. In verse 1, when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. Now remember where these places are, Gilgal and Bethel and Jericho. They're all within just 6 or 7 miles of each other. And they're all down in an area where another famous man was to come to preach a few years later on. Do you remember who that would be? John the Baptist. Now keep that in mind, because when we come to study John the Baptist, the descendants of the people around there are linking him in their minds with Elijah. Are you Elijah? Why did they say that? Because you look what happened to Elijah down in that same area. And of course, Jesus Christ was ministering down there as well. And we learned something that we wouldn't have known about otherwise, except for this chapter, and that is that they had a seminary going there, at least a graduate school. They had a school of the prophets. And they were called the sons of the prophets. I don't think we've had this before, this concept of sons of, but I just take a footnote here and mention it. In Hebrew, as a matter of fact, in the New Testament, the concept occurs as well. The idea of son of means partaking of the nature of, son of, partaking of the characteristic or character or nature of, son of. We're so literal, you know, if we are sons of the prophet, that means preacher's kids or something like that. But this does not mean that there's any blood relationship. Let me illustrate it. Sons of oil is a phrase that's used in Scripture. Sons of oil means those who have been anointed to be prophets. Those who have been anointed. And the oil, of course, was used in anointing. So, sons of oil means those men who had been anointed to a special ministry. A clearer one, sons or children of darkness and children, sons of light. You've heard that phrase, 1 Thessalonians 5 and elsewhere. A son of light is one who partakes of the nature of light, that is, partakes of the character of God. Remember 1 John 1, 5, that God is light and in him is no darkness at all. So the sons of light are those who are walking in the light. They have come to the light for salvation. They're walking in the light. They're walking in fellowship with God. They're called sons of light, sons of darkness, son of perdition, and here, sons of the prophets. And so these are sons of the prophets in the sense that they are partaking of the ministry, the character of the prophets. They are the next generation of prophets, not physically as sons of these prophets, of Elijah and Elisha, but they are those studying in this way. They were impressed by them. They were imitating them. We would say disciples. Very close to the concept of disciple. And Elijah said to Elisha, he says, stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel. Now, this is going to happen three times. And Elisha said, no, I'm going to go with you. He says, I'm not going to leave you. So they went to Bethel. Now, it's not that Elijah is trying to get rid of Elisha so much as I think he's more or less testing him. And Elisha stays very close with him. It's very interesting that when they come down to Bethel, they find some sons of the prophet, some of these students, and the students say, we know that Elijah is going to be taken away. So that proves that they were prophets in verse 3. God had revealed to them that the time had come for Elijah's ministry to finish. And this thing is repeated. They go to Bethel, they go to Jericho, and then they go down to the Jordan in verse 6. And you'll notice in verse 7, the sons of the prophets, 50 of them, stood and they looked across down to the Jordan River to see what was going on. The two stood by the Jordan. What a scene this was. All the disciples up there watching to see what would happen. And here's Elijah and Elisha standing by the Jordan River. The river is flowing with water. Are they going to go across? What's going to happen? Now, this is very interesting because Elijah takes his mantle, wraps it together, smote the waters, and they divided thither, and they walked the two of them across on dry ground. Does that remind you of anything? That's what had happened coming the other way, right? With Joshua. And approximately the same spot, because where they came out was at Gilgal near Jericho. So it'd be just about the same place. And they go right across. And then what happens? The river flows back again. You see what's happening? He's getting Elijah over there on the other, Elisha over there on the other side. Elijah goes up to heaven, then how's he going to get back? And so the stage is being set for demonstrating that God is with Elisha as much as he was with Elijah. And so he says, ask me what I shall do for you. Verse 9, the famous reply, give me a double portion of thy spirit. I suppose we could deduce mathematically from this that Elisha is saying, I'm only half the man you are, I need double the spirit. I don't know. But the thing I like about this is that he is admitting his great need of whatever Elijah had, the Spirit of God. He is admitting this. He doesn't think that because he's been with Elijah, because he's seen these miracles, he doesn't think that he can handle it by himself. He's very, very dependent upon God. And he says, you've asked a hard thing. But he says, if you're with me when the time comes, you'll get it. And you can imagine Elisha stayed with him. And they went on and they talked. I like that. They still went on and talked. What did they talk about? I don't know. About the miracles, about God, how much greater God was. And then all of a sudden, whoosh, the horses come down, the chariots, zoom, right in between them. And the only thing that's left is the mantle on the ground. And I'm sure as soon as that noise came and the sound came and the horses and the chariots went zipping through, God didn't have to do all this. He could have just picked them up with his fingers and taken them up to heaven. But he did this as a visual aid to show his power, to show that he was there. And I think as a nice little touch to Elijah's life, as much as to say to all the northern kingdom and anybody that wondered, and the prophets of Baal and all these people, Jezebel, she's still alive. She lived too long as far as Elisha was concerned. All these people, there's a God in heaven, and he approves of what Elijah did. And Ahab may have called him his enemy and the one that troubled Israel. But I'll tell you what I think of him. When I want to take him out of this life, I'm going to send down the golden chariot, and he's going to have a royal ride like a king on up to heaven. So what God is simply doing is validating the ministry and the preaching, the prophecy of Elijah. Now, if you're Elisha, what's the one thing you're concerned about? Did he take his mantle with him? And you look down, and it's down on the ground, and he picks it up, and now he goes back to the Jordan River. What's going to happen now? You're Elisha. Elijah's gone. You've got this piece of cloth. The river looks awfully deep. You remember Joshua. You remember Moses, how they parted the waters, different waters. And you remember what Elijah did and how you got over there. And there are 50 of your students on the other bank watching to see what's going to happen. I think I would have cleared my throat and looked for the nearest raft. But this famous statement comes out then in verse 19. He smote the waters and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" Well, the Lord God of Elijah was in the business again, and he parted the waters and he went through. There was a famous statement made at a great conference on missions a few years ago, as I heard Stan Mooneyham make it, and maybe you've heard it too, and I'd just like to repeat it here because it has real significance and it's a real challenge. But we say, where is the God of Elijah? And I think another question would be is, where is the Elijah of God? In other words, not only where is the God of Elijah, he's still there, but are there Elijahs who will allow God to use him in that kind of a situation? The God is there, but are the Elijahs there? And this is another question that can be asked. Well, strangely enough, after all of this had happened, these students said, "Look, we're going to send out a search team and get Elijah back." Now, if I were Elisha, I'd think, well, I'm going to be a little bit jealous of that. You know, can't they accept the fact that I'm here? I think there's a lesson in this, that God only makes one of us, each one of us, for sometimes that we can be thankful, but he only makes one of each of us, then he throws away the mold. There never was another Elijah. How do you think Joshua felt when Moses went off the scene? But he didn't have to be Moses. He could be Joshua. You may follow some great leader in a pastorate or someplace, and they may say, "Oh man, you should have been here with a guy before you. He did this and so." Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Because when God takes one person off the scene, it's because he doesn't need him there anymore. He's finished his work in his way with that person, and the next one he puts back in there will be a different person. If God still needed Elijah, Elijah would be there. But he'd finished with Elijah, and he's going to start working with Elisha. And so, much to, I guess, Elisha's chagrin and humbling, they sent a search party, and they couldn't find him. Well, in chapter 3, we find Jehoram, the second son of Ahab, coming on the scene, and he now takes the throne. Ahaziah only reigned for 2 years. And their big problem at that time was the king of Moab, who had taken occasion at the death of Ahab to stop sending in the tribute, and he had, in effect, rebelled. And so once again, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom joined together to go after the king of Moab. And as they get down there, they have no water. All of them are going to die of thirst until God moves in and does a miracle. Chapter 4, we have this scene with Elisha and the widow's oil, and then, of course, raising the little boy at Shunem and doing several miracles. You'll find these listed for you in Leon Wood. And there he notes that Elisha was a man of the city, a man that was used to being around kings, and a man of whom there are many more miracles recorded than Elijah. Elijah was a man of the country, a rough-hewn type of person. Read carefully in Leon Wood that comparison between the two of them. It's very interesting. We find a series of miracles, and in chapter 5, these even involve the general of the army of Syria, which had led the Syrians into battle against them many times. Now, Lord willing, what we'll do in our next class tomorrow will be to go right through the rest of 2 Kings. We'll survey it very briefly. We'll see the breakup of, we'll see the taking away of the northern kingdom into captivity. So be ready for that. We'll finish up 2 Kings tomorrow. Thank you.